Well, good morning. My name is Shane. I'm the youth pastor here at Washington Avenue Christian Church. And I don't know about you guys, but I enjoy the finished product of making the videos. I enjoy like getting to see them. But I'm not going to lie to you. I am so glad that we are done making those videos. Guys, like it is the worst, right? I like seeing them when they're done, but every Wednesday I'm like, we have to do another one. So we've been in this series called Meant for Good on the life of Joseph for the past 11 weeks. And I don't know about you guys, but I've really enjoyed this series because like maybe it's similar for you, but for me, like my understanding of the life of Joseph was kind of like the flannel graph Sunday school version of the life of Joseph, right? The coat of many colors and the pit and Potiphar's wife and, you know, all of these things. But there's some things in here that we've talked about that I just did not know before. And it's been really fun to dive into this story a little bit deeper and to learn some new things. And before we move forward this morning, what I want us to do is to just take a step back. I want us to pump the brakes a little bit. And I want us to look at the life of Joseph and some of the things that we've learned about Joseph in his story so far, specifically like the qualities and characteristics of Joseph. And I think that if you were to put one word over the life of Joseph, the word would be successful, right? Every single thing that Joseph did, he succeeded at. Now, yes, it was God, right? We're gonna couch that one up to the big man. We're gonna say, yeah, it was God who allowed all of these things to happen, right? But Joseph was a successful guy. It doesn't matter if he was like just being a son and was a successful son, because he was the favorite, and that's kind of like what led to a lot of the problems, right? So I don't know what it means to be a successful son, but Joseph was that. And whenever he was bought by Potiphar, it didn't take very long for Joseph to rise to the head of the household. And the text tells us that the only thing that Potiphar had to worry about was what he was going to eat every day. Joseph handled everything else. When Joseph was thrown into prison, it didn't take very long for him to rise in the ranks of the prison system and become the number two guy in all of the prison, right? It says exactly what it said about Potiphar, that the prison guard didn't have to worry about anything because Joseph handled everything. And again, whenever he rises to the number two person in the entire country of Egypt, it says Pharaoh didn't have anything to worry about because Joseph handled everything. Joseph was successful. It tells us that he was handsome, right? I told you that I pulled out the text, exactly what the text said, and the text literally said that he was handsome, and so to be faithful and true to the word, it said that he was handsome. Do with that whatever you want. I don't have any more comments on that one whatsoever, but I do know that Joseph had integrity, right? Whenever he was a slave in Potiphar's house, because he was handsome, Potiphar's wife was really, really into Joseph, right? She wanted a piece of Joseph, and so she continually presented herself to him, like, hey, Joseph, let's go hang out in my bedroom for a while. And Joseph consistently says, no, no, no. And finally, she catches him all alone one day where it's just her and him in the house, and she says, Joseph, come to bed with me. She's not playing around anymore. She says, come to bed with me. Joseph said, why would I sin against my God by going to bed with you? He doesn't say sin against myself or sin against you or sin against my master. No, it would be a sin against God to go to bed with you. Well, she's had enough of this, and so she tries to grab him and pull him to bed. He shirks his cloak and runs away, at least shirtless, probably mostly naked, away to maintain his integrity. Joseph has integrity. Because of that encounter with Potiphar's wife, he's thrown in prison. He's falsely accused and he's thrown in prison. And while he's in prison, he rises to the ranks where he is the number two guy in the entire prison system, which means that he's worrying about and dealing with all kinds of things. And in the midst of dealing with all of these different situations that come up in prison, the text tells us that the chief cupbearer and the chief butler of Pharaoh's household were thrown into prison. And Joseph oversees them. And one day he notices that they're sad, which is like, duh, they're in prison, right? Like, of course they're sad. Right? But Joseph, amongst all of the things that he's doing, notices the emotions of two prisoners. And he doesn't just notice it and like go on. It's like, of course they're in prison. Of course they're sad. No, he stops and says, hey, like, guys, what's bothering you? What's on your mind? And they tell him that that they've had dreams. They just simply don't understand. So not only is Joseph observant, but he's also consider it. He tells them what their dreams mean and what's going to come from their dreams, and he's spot on, right? 3 days later, they're released from prison, and exactly what Joseph said would happen happens. And as they're being released from prison, Joseph, the number two guy in the whole prison system, is like, hey, remember that I'm not supposed to be here, right? So, like, get me out of here. Cool? And they're like, yeah, Joseph, no problem. And then it's a problem because they forget about Joseph, right? And it's a full 2 years before Pharaoh has some dreams that need some interpreting, and they're like, oh my gosh, Joseph, he's the guy that should be doing this. And in that time, being the number two guy in the entire prison system, rather than raising a bunch of rabble or not doing his job well or complaining and moping and trying to get out of prison, Joseph is patient. He interprets the dreams for Pharaoh, and there's going to be 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine. And he says, this is coming, and God has told you this so that you may provide for all of the people, and so here's what maybe might be a good idea for you to do. And Pharaoh says, well, if only there was somebody wise and discerning who could lead this project for, oh, wait, Joseph, why don't you do it, right? Prisoner, why don't you do it? And Joseph is elevated from prison to prince, the number two in all of Egypt, because he is wise and discerning. It says that he travels all over the country, visiting every city and helping them establish a system for collecting and storing their grain and then distributing it during the time of famine. He's organized. When Joseph meets his brothers, we find out on three separate occasions that Joseph is really emotional, right? But in all of the good ways, right? He allows his emotions to be real. He feels his emotions, sadness and maybe a little bit of hurt, but also just joy and excitement at being reunited with his brothers and specifically with his fathers after so many years. And finally, we learn that Joseph is generous. Man, he takes care of his brothers who were not generous with him, who threw him in a pit for no reason whatsoever and left him to die and then sold him into slavery. Joseph, in return and in response, is generous with them. Whenever they come and bring payment for the grain that they're buying, Joseph puts the money back in the bags and sends it home with them. They do it again, and he puts the money that they paid plus some in their bags and sends it home. He invites them and throws feasts with them during a famine, right? He throws feasts for them, and he takes care of them to make sure that they are set up and taken care of. Joseph is a really, really incredible person, right? His characteristics are great. And that brings us right up to the present this morning in chapter 46, starting in verse 31 is where we're going to be today. And what I want us to do this morning is I just want to kind of summarize 46, 31 through 47, 12, because it's like a lot of text where nothing happens. And then there's another big portion of text that we'll read and we'll talk about that. So here's what happens in 46, starting in verse 31. Last week, Jacob and Joseph are reunited for the first time. It was 2 weeks ago, rather. And they're reunited for the first time, right? And the text that we were at ended in verse 31. Jacob says, let me die since I have seen your face and I know that you're still alive, which I thought was weird because it's like, why would you want to die? We haven't been around this guy for 20 years. Like, you would want that time, right? And he's just like, no, I can die now. Odd, but maybe you don't think so, and that's okay. So Joseph has that conversation with his dad, Jacob, and he turns around in verse 31 and talks to his brothers, and that's where we're going to pick up this morning. And basically, he says, hey, guys, our family, we're shepherds, right? That's what we do. We are shepherds. We take care of sheep, which is great. It's provided a lot for us. Here's the problem is that Egyptians hate shepherds. I hate them, right? My text here says that they are an abomination to Egyptians, right? Shepherds are an abomination. So Pharaoh's going to ask you what you guys do. And you guys are going to say that we herd livestock, which apparently in the echelon of careers is much higher on the list than like being a shepherd, right? So we don't tell them that you're a shepherd, tell them that you herd livestock and it's way better for you, right? I don't get it, but they did, right? It's kind of weird. So Joseph's like, we're gonna herd livestock, brothers, okay, cool. So Joseph, remember, he's in his chariot. So he jumps back in his chariot and he skips on home and he goes to Pharaoh and is like, hey, Pharaoh, my family, they're here finally. Like my dad and my brothers, all these guys, there's 70 of them and it's a famine. So like, where do you want me to put them? Pharaoh's like, what do they do? Like, what can they contribute? And Joseph's like, well, they are herdsmen. You know, they herd livestock. Pharaoh's like, oh, great. Like, we need that. Cool. There's this land called Goshen. It's right outside of town here, right outside of the capital city. And it's pretty spacious and pretty open. Why don't your family just settle there, right? Which is perfect because it's a little bit separated. So Jacob and all of his family, they settle in Goshen. And verse 12 says this, and Joseph provided his father and his brothers and all of his father's household with food according to the number of their dependents. There were 70 of them. There were 70 dependents that were there. The text has already told us that. So Joseph personally provides all of the food that his family needs for all 70 people. And that's everything that's happened from 46:31 to 47:12. There's an interesting little interaction between Jacob and Pharaoh, but we won't get into that right now. Pick up with me in verse 13. We're actually going to read now. Now, there was no food in all of the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished by reason of the famine. Joseph, he gathered up all of the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan in exchange for the grain that they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. And when the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all of the Egyptians, they came to Joseph and said, yo, Joseph, give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? All of our money is gone. Joseph answered, give me your livestock and I will give you food in exchange for your livestock if your money is gone. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses and the flocks and the herds and the donkeys, and he supplied them with food in exchange for their livestock that year. And when that year had ended, they came to him the following year and said to him, we will not hide from you, Joseph, the fact that our money is gone, and our herds of our livestock already belong to you. Joseph, there is nothing left in the sight of you but our bodies and our land. Joseph, why should we die before your eyes, both us and the land? So buy us and our land for food, and we will with our land be servants to Pharaoh, and give us seed that we may live and not die, and that the land may not become desolate. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, and for all the Egyptians sold their fields because the famine was so severe. The land became Pharaoh's, and as for the people, he made servants of them from one end of Egypt to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had a fixed allowance from Pharaoh and lived on the allowance of the Pharaoh, gave them, therefore they did not need to sell their land. Then Joseph said to the people, behold, I have this day bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is your seed that you should sow in the land. And at the harvest you shall give one-fifth to Pharaoh, and four-fifths shall be your own, as seed for the field and as food for yourselves and as for your household and for food for your little ones. And they said to Joseph, you have saved our lives. May it please you, Joseph, we will be servants to Pharaoh. So Joseph made a statute concerning the land of Egypt, and it stands to this day that Pharaoh should have the fifth. The land of the priests alone did not become Pharaoh's. And I won't lie to you, this has been a struggle for me this week. I started getting ready for this a couple of weeks ago and like looking through this sermon and through this text, and I would go home every single night from work and be like, babe, I don't know. I don't know what we're supposed to do with this. Because to me, there's not much here. Like, sure, we could talk about like how effective Joseph was at, you know, managing and distributing all of these things, but it's not really a sermon, right? So like, what am I supposed to do with this? And I won't lie to you, it was pretty late in the week whenever I was like, I should pay attention, because there's, I think, something here. Let me set up a little bit of context for us. See, I didn't realize until this week that everything that's happened in the life of Joseph and his brothers from the time that they came to visit him from the first time to this moment, all of the back and forth between Egypt and Canaan and Egypt and Canaan and Egypt and Canaan, all of that happened in the first 2 years of the famine, which means that there are still 5 years of this famine to go. And we get here a snapshot of what happened in those 5 years. Things are not good, right? Things are not good. The Egyptians are out of money and they're out of livestock and seed and they're out of land, right? Things are really, really not good. And in order to understand this, we need to understand some things about some words here that show up in this text, primarily slavery, right? Which is like, ugh, nobody wants to talk about that, and understandably so. We need to understand that the Bible has a lot to say in regards to slavery, right? In the Old Testament, it talks a lot about slavery, and it says mostly how bad of a thing it is, right? The Israelites, they were slaves on a couple of different occasions between the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Assyrians and all of these things. But in the New Testament, where you would expect there to be a hard line, no, slavery is bad, it's not there. We have to understand a little bit culturally of what it meant to be a slave there, and we'll get to that here in a little bit. But one thing that just like jumped off the page to me as I was reading this scripture as a red-blooded American Texas-born kid is these people did what? Like they sold, they gave all their money to Joseph, first of all. And then they sold their livestock, right? Understandable. And then things get really, really, really bad. And so they go to Joseph. They go to Joseph and say, why don't you make us your slaves? And I don't know about you, but I think it would take a lot for me to like willingly go and say, hey, like I'll be your slave, right? I'd rather just like eat dirt and suck on rocks than like be a slave to somebody, right? It bucks up against every single thing that we know and understand and believe. And so the question is, like, what are these people thinking? This is not a power grab by Joseph. I want to be very clear about that. Like, Joseph is not saying, well, now you get to be my slaves. And no, they come to Joseph and they say, let us be your slaves. And the question is, why? See, the thing is that, man, Joseph has proven to us as readers, Joseph has proven to his family and to Pharaoh and to the nation of Egypt exactly the kind of person that he is, right? We've already talked about it. Joseph, he is capable and he is intelligent. He is wise. He is kind. He is trustworthy. He is patient. He is selfless. This is the most tyrannical thing that Joseph does as their master. Here's what it is. It's in verse 21. Your text probably says something like, as for the people, he made servants of them once from one end of Egypt to the other, right? Does it say something like that in your Bibles? Give me a yes, give me a no. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, thank you, cool. That's wrong, right? I am no Hebrew scholar. I don't know a lick of Hebrew, but I read a bunch of guys who do, and they are all pretty much universally agree that this is a really, really bad translation of verse 21. Because what the Hebrew text says is Joseph distributed the people to cities. He didn't make servants of them, right? The text does not say that. It says that he distributed them to cities, right? So he took all the country folk, and he says, guys, here's what I need you to do. I need you to pack your bags and move to town so that we can have as much land as possible to graze our cattle and plant the seed so that we can make it through this together. That's the most tyrannical thing that Joseph does. Sure, he implements a 20% tax, all right? He says, you get to do whatever it is that you do to make money, you get to do whatever it is that you do to make a living, and you get to keep 80% of that, but I need 20% if we're gonna get through this together. I need 20% from what you make, what you reap, what you sow. 20%. And it was such an effective strategy that the author of Genesis in verse 26 says, Joseph made a statute concerning the land of Egypt, and it stands to this day. Genesis was written probably 500 years after these events, right? 500 years, and Joseph's tax is still in place. 500 years, that's his legacy. That's the most tyrannical thing he did, is like, hey, I need you to move over here, and I'm gonna take 20%. Doesn't sound like a terrible master to me by any stretch. And the people, they were willing to submit themselves to Joseph as their slave master because they had watched Joseph for the last 20 years. They had watched Joseph for the last 10 years run and manage their country. They knew Joseph. They trusted Joseph. And when you trust your master, slavery doesn't feel very much like slavery. when you trust your master, slavery doesn't feel very much like slavery. It feels like, hey, move over here for a little bit and pay me a little bit of taxes. And I mentioned before, guys, that the Bible is just kind of ambivalent on slavery. It really is. And as much as I wish that it would be more hardlined on it, it's not. Even in the New Testament, there's a whole book called Philemon. If you haven't read it, you should, because it's fantastic. And what happens in the book of Philemon is that it's a letter written by a guy named Paul. And Paul has a relationship with the guy named Philemon. And Philemon has a slave named Onesimus. And Onesimus has run away. Right? He has stolen things and he has run away. And somewhere along the way, Onesimus bumps into Paul. And when Onesimus bumps into Paul, Paul does what Paul does and he preaches the gospel to him. And Onesimus becomes, a believer. He becomes a believer in Jesus. And Paul looks Onesimus square in the face and says, "You know what your next step is, Onesimus?" And he was like, "I don't, whatever I want, because I'm free in Christ, right?" And he's like, "No, your next step is to go back to Philemon and to enter back into his household. Here's a letter. I want you to take it to him, and it will explain everything." And in the letter, to Philemon, Paul says, "Hey, Onesimus wronged you. But because of the mutual blood of Jesus that covers all of us, accept him back. Not as a slave, but as a brother." That's the hardest line that we get on slavery in the New Testament. And there's not much in Ephesians and in a couple of other places. It talks about how, like, slaves submit to your masters and these types of things. And we have to understand that culturally, like, slavery then was not slavery that we are familiar with. It's not the slavery that has been a part of our historical culture here in America. It's very, very different. And for all of the ways that the Bible talks about slavery, it really chooses to use slavery as a metaphor for other and bigger things. Look with me, and it'll be on the screens behind me if you don't want to turn there. Romans chapter 6, starting in verse 15, it says this: "What then? Are we to sin because we are not under law, but under grace?" See, Paul in Romans he's having an argument almost with himself. He's writing this letter to these people who he's never met, and he's trying to anticipate every single question that they're going to ask him. And so earlier on in chapter 6, he's talking about how wonderful grace is, and the people, he's drawing a logical conclusion that, well, like, if grace is awesome and sin is bad, but grace covers it, shouldn't we sin more so we get more grace, and therefore it's a good thing, right? Paul's like, no. Absolutely not. He says, by no means. Or maybe your version says absolutely or not, or certainly not. And the Greek there, it's the word meganoita, right? And it's called an emphatic negation. And it's not like, oh, you silly goose, no. It's like, absolutely not, right? It is as emphatic as you can possibly get. Get creative and then put a no behind it. And that's what Paul is saying. Absolutely not. What then? Are we to sin because we are not under the law but under grace? Absolutely not. Don't you know that if you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you are slaves to the one to whom you obey, either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness. Thanks be to God that you who were once slaves of sin have become obedient from the heart to the standard of teaching to which you have committed yourselves. And having been set free from sin, you have become slaves to righteousness. He says, I'm speaking in human terms because of your natural limitations. Like, I know that it's really hard for you guys to understand these big concepts. So I'm using slavery as a metaphor for what Jesus has done for us. That's what he's saying in verse 19. I am speaking metaphorically because you guys have a hard time understanding. For just as you once presented your members as slaves to impurity and to lawless, which leads to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves to righteousness, which leads to sanctification. And those are two really, really, really big words that we have to understand in order to get what Paul is saying here. So let's talk about righteousness, right? Righteousness is one of the single most important biblical terms in the entire Bible story, and it goes all the way back to Genesis 12. What it means to be righteous is to be faithful to a covenant. To be faithful to a covenant, and the covenant that we know and are most familiar with is Genesis chapter 12, where God appears to Abram and says, I want you to leave this land and go over here, and I will make your family into a blessed nation, a great nation who will bless the whole world. It will be a light unto the Gentiles, Abraham. Abraham's like, cool, God, that sounds awesome, except I'm 99 and I don't have a kid. So this whole like family thing is a little bit weird, right? But I got this awesome servant over here. His name's Eleazar. He's a great guy. So like him? And God's like, no, you're going to have an actual family. God says, here's what I want you to do, Abraham. I want you to go get 2 cows and a goat and a bull and some doves and something else. I don't know. It doesn't matter. He says, I want you to cut them in half. Okay. So Abraham goes and he gets all of these animals and he cuts them in half. See, this is how you made a covenant in the ancient world, is you took an animal and you cut it in half, and then you and whoever you're entering into covenant with, you would link arms and you would walk through the blood and the guts of the animal together. Sounds awesome, right? I like paper contracts a lot better. Just sign it and be done. And what it symbolizes is this, is that if I fail to uphold my end of the bargain, or if this person fails to uphold their end of the bargain, then what has happened to this animal, may that happen to me. Tear me apart if I don't do what I say that I'm going to do. So God tells Abraham, I want you to go get all these animals. Cut them up, spread them out. Okay. Says the sun went down, and Abraham fell asleep. And God descended from heaven to earth in a pot, smoke, and fire. And God alone passed through the blood and the guts. And what God is saying is that if I don't live up to my end of the bargain, Abraham, then may what has happened to these animals, may that happen to me. And Abraham, if you don't live up to your end of the bargain, then may what has happened to these animals happen to me. It is a massive, massive statement. And we know through the rest of the Old Testament and all the way up into the New Testament, there's this winding backwards and forwards, topsy-turvy, but straight line story of God keeping his covenant in a surprising, unexpected way by a man named Jesus, who was God's son, fully God and fully human in the flesh, on earth for 33 years, preaching and teaching about this kingdom that's coming, and it's here, and he shows us how to live, and he shows us what to do, and he tells us what to do, and his reward for that was a cross. His reward for being faithful was God fulfilling his end of the bargain that he made with Abraham. Abraham, you didn't live up to your end of the covenant because you're human, because you're broken, and you sin. And Abraham couldn't do it, and Isaac couldn't do it, Jacob couldn't do it, Joseph couldn't do it, and I can't, and you can't, but God, through Jesus, did. He went to the cross for us, fulfilling his end of the bargain and ours. His end of the bargain and ours. That's what righteousness is. That's what it means to be righteous. You may be thinking to yourself, okay, that's cool that God did that. And like, Jesus, that's awesome, man. I want to hear more about that. But also, like you said, that like it says that we're slaves to righteousness. So what does that mean for us? Is that Abraham did have a job to do. And his job was to obey and to be a light to the Gentiles, to people who don't believe, don't know about God. And friends, that's our job too, right? Like, that's our end of the bargain. That's what it means to be slaves to righteousness, is that we do what we're supposed to do. And man, the people of Egypt, they were more than willing to submit themselves to Joseph because they trusted their master. And when you trust your master, man, slavery doesn't feel like slavery. And here's the thing, guys. Joseph is the best character in the Old Testament. And I'm not just saying that from like a personal position or anything, but like literally, Joseph is the only primary character of the Old Testament who we can't quite identify where he sinned. Some people might say, well, he like bragged to his brothers about them like bowing down to him, you know, as a cocky little kid. And it's like, maybe so. But Abraham lied, and Jacob was a trickster, and David, you know, like had the whole Bathsheba thing, so it's like murder, adultery, right? Like there are some big dudes with big problems, and Joseph doesn't really have one. Joseph is the symbol of Jesus in the Old Testament. He's one of the primary symbols of Jesus in the Old Testament. Here's the thing about Joseph. Joseph's 100% man, right? 100% human, which means that even though we don't have recordings of it, even though we can't pinpoint it or put our finger on it, we know for a fact that somewhere along the way Joseph sinned. Because he was human, right? It's what happens. And if the people who knew Joseph and had watched him and knew that he sinned, but were confident in saying, Joseph, be our master. If that was their position with Joseph, how much more then ought we to be absolutely confident to approach the throne of Jesus, who was 100% man and 100% God, and say, would you be our master? Can we be your slaves? Would you buy us as your slaves? And here's the mind-blowing thing about it. In Galatians chapter 4, starting in verse 4, it says, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were slaves to the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons and daughters. And because you are sons of God, he has sent the spirit of his son, Jesus, into our hearts to cry out, Abba, Father. And here it is, guys, verse 7. So you are no longer slaves, but sons and daughters. And if you're a son, if you're a daughter, then you're an heir through God. The Egyptians, they trusted Joseph. And when you trust your master, slavery doesn't feel like slavery. And when you know and you trust Jesus, and you trust your master, slavery doesn't feel like slavery. It really feels like family. Because we're not slaves anymore. Our task is to do our jobs. Just do what we've been called to do and leave the rest up to Jesus. It's been taken care of. Everything. Paul told us in Romans, he says, guys, whatever you choose to submit yourself to, that you are a slave to. And I would love to stand up here this morning confidently and say, I only choose to submit myself to Jesus. He is my one and only master. But to do that would be a lie. For me to stand up here and declare that Jesus is my one and only master is a lie, because every single day I choose to obey other things. Every single day I choose to obey my wants and my desires. I choose to obey temptations and lies and whispers, even when I know that Jesus is more and is better. And forgive me for assuming too much, but I think that you do too. So, what are we going to do about that? That's the question for us this morning, is what do we do about multiple masters? You see, only one of these masters has the power to save you, has the power to fulfill you, has the power to give you the something better that you're looking for. And it's not fear. It's not power. It's not money. It's not alcohol or drugs or greed or lust or pride. It's Jesus. He is the only one. He is the only master who can do what he says he's going to do. And the thing about Jesus is that he's a lot like Joseph, only better. Joseph was like, yeah, I'll be your master, right? Or Pharaoh, he'll be your master. You just move over here and give me some taxes and we'll call it good, right? Just do your thing, right? Joseph was a great master. Like, I'd work for that guy. But Jesus is even better. Jesus is not the you know, the slave-driving, whip-cracking, like, angry, aggressive master that we think of when we think about masters. He's not here to take out all of his anger on us whenever he's had a bad day. No, actually, he took out all of his bad day, all of our bad days on himself. Like, that's the kind of master that Jesus is. He took out all of our bad days on himself so that you didn't have to. So the guys are going to come up here. They're going to lead us in a song here in just a minute. And we're going to get just, because I don't really know what to do with this, but I'm going to give you guys some options. You can do whatever you want, or you can do none of these options. That's fine with me. It's none of my business. But we're going to sing a song. It's called No Longer Slaves. And the chorus goes, I'm no longer a slave to fear. And maybe you need to say that today. Maybe you need to stand up and like boldly declare, I am no longer a slave to fear. Maybe fear isn't the thing that you struggle with. So what I want you to do is let's get a little bit creative this morning. And I want you to identify and figure it out. What is the thing? What is the thing that is holding you back? What is the thing that you allow to master you day after day? And maybe what you need to do is you just need to stand up and boldly declare, I am no longer a slave to greed or to lust or to pride or alcohol. Maybe that's what you need to do. Or maybe what you need to do is just stay right in your seat. Because maybe you don't know what you're a slave to. And you don't know what it means to be a slave to Jesus, which sounds weird. And you're not even sure about this whole slavery thing, much less this whole like Jesus thing. And maybe you just need to figure that out. And if you have questions about that, man, like come grab me or one of these people up front. We'd be more than happy to talk to you about what that might can mean for you. And we'd love to help you identify and figure out like who your master is, because we want to help you guys at Washington Avenue. We don't do things alone. So like, this is not only your job to do. You don't have to do this all on your own. We are here for you. In your Connect card, there's a little perforated edge. You don't have to put your name on it, but what I would love for you to do, what I would challenge you to do, is identify what your master is, like the thing that controls you, and I want you to write it out. Like be bold and be confident enough to write it out, and then I want you to put it in one of these boxes around the room, because I can personally guarantee you that when you do that, you are saying, I'm not doing this alone. And I can personally guarantee you that tomorrow morning, right over here in the fireside room at 9 o'clock, the entire Washington Avenue Christian Church staff is going to be praying for you about that thing. Because we don't do things alone here at Washington Avenue, we do it together. You can't beat the thing, you can't throw off the chains of your master by yourself. You have to have Jesus. And you have to have a church body surrounding you, praying for you, helping you. So maybe that's what you do, right? And I'm going to get crazy here for a second, but this is 11 o'clock, and I think that you guys can handle it, all right? Maybe what you need to do is be really, really bold and bring that Connect card right up here to the stage, platform, whatever you want to call it. Just leave it here. Like, that's all you have to do. If you want to pray, that's cool. If you want somebody to pray with you, awesome. But you don't have to do that. But what I want to challenge you guys to do is leave this at the foot of the only place where there's power enough to overcome that thing, and that's the foot of the cross. So be bold. Be bold. Paul tells us, guys, you choose who your master is. Whatever you obey is who your master is. So choose the best master, Joseph. Joseph proved over and over and over and over again that he was a capable master for these people. And guys, Jesus has proved over and over and over and over and over again that he is a capable and competent and powerful and loving and gentle and kind and wise master for us. So choose. Because when you know, when you trust, when you love your master, slavery doesn't feel like slavery, friends. It feels like family. And there's no better feeling in the world than family. So God, thank you that you, we could have been so happy being your slaves. Like if slavery was the option, sign me up. But you said, no slavery, you're no longer slaves, you're sons, daughters. And that's overwhelming. God, maybe you're not our master because we don't know you, because we don't trust you. Would you just like show yourself to us? Would you just reveal yourself to us a little bit more today, maybe in a conversation, or maybe just like by the power of your Holy Spirit, or maybe it's in some reading or in a song. God, would you just like reveal yourself to us so that we can trust you a little bit more and a little bit better, so that we know that slavery can feel like family. God, we got some decisions to make this morning. We got to figure out who we're going to follow and who we're going to obey. So would you give us confidence? Would you give us boldness? Would you give us courage and conviction to do what is necessary to figure out who we're going to follow and then do it? God, walking up in front of a room and putting a little piece of paper on a stage is stupid. Doesn't really mean much, God, but it could mean everything. So would you give us boldness and confidence to step out and do that this morning? Thank you for Jesus, who could have made us slaves, could have made us, you know, whatever he wanted, but he chose to make his family. It's in his name we pray. Amen.
Hey church, we're so glad you tuned in today. If you need prayer or have questions about this week's message or what it means to follow Jesus, you can message us on Facebook or visit our contact page on our website at whackonline.org. If you're interested in joining our church family, we have the next steps available for you on our website as well. Remember, we are real people experiencing real grace. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.